The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Bose is the presenting partner of Beyond the Grid. That's because Bose Quiet Comfort 35-2 goes beyond what you would expect from a pair of headphones. Just flip the switch to experience the industry-leading active noise reduction feature, and all distractions of the world around you fade away, allowing you to focus fully on what matters to you.
Hello, I'm Martin Brundle, and you're listening to Beyond the Grid.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Beyond the Grid with me, Tom Clarkson. Now, it's hard to know how to introduce this week's guest because he's a guy some of you will think you know pretty well already. He's been communicating his passion for Formula One to TV viewers around the world for the past 22 years. And his enthusiasm for the sport remains as infectious today as it was when he retired from racing. I'm talking, of course, about Martin Brundle. Although many of our younger listeners will be more familiar with his commentary than his racing career, don't forget that he was a mighty fine peddler who on his day raced and beat the best of his generation. And I include names like Ayrton Senna and Michael Schumacher on that list. Martin's done much in his career, and I always love catching up with him because his take on the sport and what he achieved in it is both compelling and unique. Here's what happened when we caught up recently over a cuppa in the Mercedes motorhome. Martin, welcome to Beyond the Grid. You've had such a varied, eclectic career, it's quite difficult to know where to start. So I'm going to say this to you. You retired from F1 22 years ago. And so lots of people listening to this will be more familiar with Martin Brundle, the commentator, than Martin Brundle, the racing driver. How does that make you feel?
Well, I still think I'm a racing driver who commentates on races. I think like a driver, I mean, kidding myself, I still race a bit here and there, but that's my mentality. I started banger racing on old cars when I was 12. Somehow found my way through touring hot rods, touring cars, junior single seaters, back to touring cars, and then raced the great Ayrton Senna in Formula 3, and bang, I was a Formula 1 driver, still selling Toyotas during the week for the first few races of 1984, till I realised I'd actually become a professional driver. So I'm very proud of both of my careers in motorsport. The media one has probably gone even better than the driving one. I look back on my Formula One career with some frustration because I underperformed my potential. You know, I raced hard against the likes of Senna and Schumacher and Hakkinen and my contemporaries, the big stars of that time. I won a lot of races in Formula 3, World Sports Car Championship, Daytona, Le Mans. You know, I did a lot of winning. So I look back with satisfaction on my driving career and some frustration. My TV career is a complete mystery to me. I didn't want to go in the commentary box. I moaned and kicked and screamed.
Did you really?
I just didn't want to do it at all. I wanted to be a Formula One driver.
Refused to accept that you weren't an F1 driver.
Yeah, I thought I was driving for Jordan in 1997. Now I'm up in the commentary box with the great Murray Walker. And they started forming up on the grid, and I was screaming inside, stop, wait, I'm not ready, you can't go yet, I'm not ready to race, you know. And then I got some quite nice comments on the following week about my commentary, well, maybe it's not that bad, but I just didn't get the point of being a commentator.
How long did it take for you to get that point? When did you get it?
A year or two, and then, you know, people started to say very nice things about what I was doing, and I was getting good write-ups, and I realised I was adding value to people's enjoyment of a sport that I loved in Formula One. So, I kind of realised then, I came to terms with the fact that my Grand Prix career was over, but I carried on racing, of course, with Nissan, Toyota and Bentley at Le Mans and some other stuff, and driving the McLaren two-seater whenever I got a chance at Grand Prix, and driving the cars for TV, so I could still satiate my absolute desire and need to go fast. But then I was building a media career at the same time.
Desire and need to go fast leads me into what actually attracted you to race driving? Was it speed? Was it a desire to impress the girls? Can you just wind back the clock? Can you remember that first moment where you thought, this is what I wanted to do? And can you explain why you wanted to do it?
Well, I used to build all my own racing cars in the beginning, which I enjoyed, on the technical side, and just being hands-on, just winning, basically. Just that need to be faster than everybody else. Even in my banger racing days, my Ford Anglia 105E. So I think, and that thrill of sort of you and the car versus the track and the elements and your main competitors, making it go faster, making yourself better, being brave down into the first corner, all the skill sets you need to win races, just, and adrenaline is far and away the best drug to get hooked on. And I think you do as a racing driver. And that you kind of, almost especially as a Formula One driver, you're kind of almost rated every day of your life. It's not an annual review or a career review. It's how fast were you, you know, on that day, testing, practicing, qualifying, racing. We used to do a lot of testing back in those days, and you're kind of measured. And I like that. And in many respects, I think that's why I love doing the TV work, because being live on air is about 30% as thrilling and scary as sitting on the grid, which is one of the best I've found so far in terms of the thrill. And I like the edginess of it. I like the instant decisions and calls and just being challenged in every way, mentally and not so much obviously physically in the commentary box, but that is, it's all part of it. So my analogy then is finished by, you know, how fast was I? How big is the TV audience? How happy are the TV audience? So your metrics just transfer to something else.
Well, let's put some flesh on those bones. How fast were you?
I think in a sports car, I was one of the very best. In a single seater, I lacked a tiny bit. So I could beat, and I did, Senna, Schumacher and Hakkinen on my day. I beat them all. In the same car on the same day, and Michael I could outrace quite frequently through 1992, but he was a new boy back then to Formula One, Michael Schumacher. But the key part of that statement is on my day. But of course, the great champions and the multiple winners don't have a day; they're always on it every day, and that's the key difference.
What triggered your day? Do you believe in form in cricket and all sport, or do racing drivers have form in that way?
Yeah, I think you do. I think you get a setup at a circuit. Circuit suits your driving style. I was always on the back foot with my career a little bit. The main reason for that was I smashed myself up in 1984. Smashed my legs up in a Tyrrell. So I lost momentum, and then I moved into other Formula One teams. But where that really hurt me is that as I knocked my left foot off my leg, which thankfully they found a way to screw it back on, Prof Watkins, stopped them in Dallas cutting my foot off, which would have been the end of my racing career, because they were three-pedal cars back then.
They were going to amputate your foot.
And
Sid stepped in.
Yeah, got me home to Harley Street. We found a guy who found a way to screw it back on, which was fine when you've got a two-pedal car, because your left foot's only got to work the clutch pedal. Then we went, it's a three-pedal car, then we went to two-pedal cars, obviously with paddle shift gearboxes, and you've got a throttle on your, like a car, throttle on your right foot and a brake pedal on your left foot. And I couldn't left foot brake with any kind of finesse.
So because you lack feeling in that foot?
Yeah, my foot doesn't work very well. So I was still right foot braking. Then I had to compete with Michael and Mika. It was a hindrance because they could rotate the car in the slow corners and just use their left foot on the brake and pick up the throttle, transfer between the two pedals in a way that I just couldn't do. So unfortunately, that crash in Dallas probably is the key reason I underperformed. And also, there were some other things. I don't think I ever quite had enough self-belief, which is strange, because whenever I got in a Jaguar, I felt invincible, and I usually was in the World Sports Car Championship. So sport's about your head, about your confidence, and I think that's the big difference between the greats and the merely very goods.
Do you think your lack of karting had something to do with it as well? I mean, what was it? It was dirt track and touring cars. Had you been karting from the age of four, do you think you would have been
able to? Yeah, it would have helped me. I never kart raced. I never forget a day Ayrton overtook me in Formula 3 in the rain at Silverstone. He went down the outside of me into Stowe, and it was torrential rain. I was leading, and he went so deep. I actually always remember shouting out loud, "See, you wouldn't want to be out there." He went all the way around the outside of Stowe on the karting line, of which I had no experience of because I never did karting. Came out in front of me. And how did he do that? The race was red flagged because Kiki Mansilla went off. So as we're going round to the grid again to reform for the second part of the race, I thought, I'm going to try Ayrton's line. Went down the outside, hit a puddle of water, down the grass, skimmed the barrier, just survived. Got back to the grid, thought that was a bit of a lucky escape. Restarted the second part of the race. This time, Ayrton won the drag race down to Stowe. I followed him home, I finished second. And on the podium, I said to him, your line into Stowe in the second part of the race didn't work, did it? And he said, I don't know, I didn't try, it was too wet. He just had this knowledge, he had this gift, and he had this experience that I didn't have. But that's no excuse. So, it is, you've got to get yourself into the right cars, but the best drivers always end up in the best cars.
It's extraordinary, isn't it, how you beat Senna in Formula 3, yet you say one of the things that held you back in Formula 1 was a lack of confidence. You would have thought that would have made you the most supremely confident driver out there to have beaten Senna, yet it didn't transfer into Formula 1.
No, well, I think that confidence, that knowledge is in and out of the car. So Ayrton had a certain gravitas.
Even
in F3 days? He was clearly, we both went to Formula 1 at the end of 1983, straight from Formula 3. But let's be honest, Senna was going to Formula 1 anyway, wasn't he? So I was in the Tyrrell, which was a bit of a challenge from time to time. And as I said, I smashed myself up in six races in. And so you lose momentum. And I never really got in the right team at the right time. I ended up at McLaren, but only because Prost didn't want to drive it in the McLaren Peugeot. So you end up with some challenging situations, whereas in sports car racing, Tom Walkinshaw was the boss. He just thought I was the best thing ever, and it gave me the confidence. I barely ever scratched one of his cars. I won loads of races for him in touring cars, in Formula One cars, in sports cars, rather. And so I think it may have been, maybe I needed that kind of environment to really give my best, whereas maybe Senna was a bit like Prost and Michael Schumacher, where they galvanized a team and made it their team, got all the right people around them. So I think a lot of this opportunity is driven as much out of the car as what you achieve behind the wheel when you're out on track.
Now, we've talked about Senna a bit already. You've been asked about him hundreds of times, but was he ever a mate, just through shared experience of, Snetterton on a rainy Monday test day? Was that shared experience ever a bonding factor for the two of you?
We did have lots of good chats. I remember after the race in Cadwell Park, where actually he crashed in qualifying, we were trading pole position lap after lap after lap until he went off at the mountain. How he didn't break his legs in that crash, I don't know, and I'm pleased he didn't, but his car, when you saw his car afterwards, it's a miracle he didn't break his left leg. So we had a long chat after the race, so it was friendly, but then as the season unraveled for him and I started beating him and went into the last round ahead of him in the championship, it got a bit fractious. He ended up his car on top of my car. We had a massive near miss at Snetterton. It all got a little bit personal. He got his license endorsed twice for dangerous driving, and he saw me as part of the British establishment. All of the traits I saw in Ayrton in 1983 in Formula 3, I saw later on in Formula 1. He was pretty convinced the world was against him and the FIA was against him and so on and so forth. But he had a gift, and I've already told you the Silverstone story, which explains that Ayrton knew where the grip was before and during a corner, whereas most of us were during and after a corner. he had a, for me, he's the greatest driver of all time. But then don't you often think whatever era you're in, you thought it was the best or whoever you're up against, but others would argue differently.
But even when you're in F1 and you're, you know, in Japan and you've been through so much together that in your careers, that did he ever let his guard down with you more than other drivers?
We had a chat occasionally, and funny enough, I met him in the lift at the hotel the night before he died. And it was a pretty tense weekend, as we all know, with Roland Ratzenberger and Rubens Barrichello. Somewhat different, but serious incidents. We were never close. That was partly my fault, I guess. We'd sort of come through together. He was annoyed my career started better than his in Formula One. He was with Tolman, I was with Tyrrell. Fifth in my first race, second in my sixth race, I think it was, before I smashed myself up the following weekend. So, we would acknowledge, we'd stop and have a chat. I've seen a few photographs of us chatting away, especially when I moved to McLaren. I took his seat at McLaren when he elected to go to Williams, if you think about it. So, we never really sat down and talked about old times or had a drink together.
You've been in such a privileged position in that you've raced Senna, you've been teammate to Stirling Moss in touring cars, teammate to Schumacher, teammate to Hakkinen. Is there a common trait among all those guys?
Yes, I think it is the confidence, the gravitas. I mean, completely different characters, actually. The four you just mentioned are wildly different characters. Just come at it in different ways, in different eras to an extent. I tell you what it is, it's those little moments where you get this glimmer of opportunity and somehow it falls for them, they make it happen. And that's the moment where you miss the gear, snatch the brake, or somebody runs into you, or the car breaks down, and somehow they've got this
winning. Can you give me an example? Could we say, is Belgium 92 an example of that?
That's the example that was in my head, actually. When it is, I'm following Michael. We're third and fourth. We can see the two all-dominant Williams, but it's a bit of a wet, dry day. I come around Lecombe at the top of the hill, and I'm thinking, it's drying out. I felt grip. I felt really good grip there. I think I've got nothing to lose. I'm fourth. I'll go in for slicks. We came out just before Stavelo. Michael runs wide, bounces down the grass. He's got a very low front wing on the Benetton. I'm thinking he must have broken his front wing. I could still see the Williams. It was a little bit wetter down there at Stavelo. And I hesitated. I hesitated to go in the pits. And it was a critical moment. So Michael's now behind me. He sees how blistered my rear tyres are when we get to the bus stop. I'm thinking, because you had to go down the pit lane before the bus stop then, shall I, shan't I? He's now got nothing to lose. He thinks he might have damaged his front wing. He sails down the pit lane, gets the hot tyres that were ready for me, if I'd have wanted them, comes out and wins the race. And it's just those little tiny...
Why didn't you pit? Have you asked yourself that question a thousand times?
Fairly regularly, actually, even all these years later. And what it was, you know, it's like, hang on a minute, I'm third. The two Williams were all dominant that year. It was very hard to beat. And I finished third a few times. And it was Schumacher's out. It's a little bit wetter down here. Don't go one lap too early on the tyres. So it was just that slight hesitation. What I should have done is followed my instincts at the top of the hill that there was grip. Michael would then have had to wait for me to get my tyres, which would have stuffed his race. I'd have gone out of the pits and won the race. Instead, he got his first victory. And it's, you know, it's tiny little turning points like that that make the difference.
Momentum.
Momentum, confidence, and that certain champion's judgment and gift.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
What did winning the World Sports Car Championship do for you and your career?
It was, I think, a reward for... I was very good in long distance racing. My son's the same, actually. Give me a car for 2.5 hours and I'll bring it back in one piece as fast as anybody at any time on the fuel, and you get in a rhythm, you get in a fantastic rhythm. Ask me to do a qualifying lap and beat Michael Schumacher and I'll be a tenth or two shy, because it's a different quality, different discipline. So I think when you get into the longer races, I think the year I was lucky enough to win them all, I think I did 12 hours all told, and I could just drive forever on the pace. So I think it was just a reward for being very good in that field and, you know, nursing a car, working with the team. And these are big operations. I mean, Le Mans with 5 Jaguars, 15 drivers, actually the logistics makes Formula One look a bit small in many respects. And I loved those cars. You could really push the massive downforce. You could really, you had to boss them about a little bit. A big 7-litre V12 over your shoulder. Yeah, you had to stay on top of those. I had a confidence in this. It's odd, isn't it? I had a supreme confidence in those cars that I never got in a Formula One car.
And do you think you could have beaten a Schumacher if he'd been your teammate in a sports car?
Well, I did race Michael because in 91 in sports cars, and I had the measure of him. He was clearly the best of the young Mercedes drivers. Mm. But, you know, Michael grew into the driver he was. You know, I raced him when he was in his very early stages of Formula One. He learned how to galvanise a team, get everybody pointing in his direction. A few crafty tricks along the way, which is another important element of the champions. The answer is, that's trying to say I was as good as Michael Schumacher, which clearly I wasn't.
Now, the man who ran the Jaguars was Tom Walkinshaw.
Yeah.
For the listeners who aren't aware of him, he was... hard-nosed Scott, is that a fair description?
It was tough,
Tom?
Yeah.
But here's a common theme throughout your career. What would you have achieved had you not come across Tom Walkinshaw?
Well, very little. I'd have been a Toyota dealer in West Norfolk. So I was racing in British Touring Car Championship. I heard about this new BMW Championship. So I wrote to Tom Walkinshaw and said, look, I'm 19 years old. I think I'm going to be a top touring car racer. There's a race coming up at my home track at Snetterton. Will you please put me in the car?
You wrote a letter.
I wrote a letter, yeah, which sadly I don't have a copy of.
And he replied.
And he replied, basically, and they gave me a test in this car. And I turned up and I had an epic race with Andy Rouse and Frank Sittner, two of the top touring car drivers of the day. They put me in the car next time. Now I'm up against Alan Jones, Hans Stuck, Nigel Mansell.
19-year-old Brundle against guys who just won the World Championship.
Yeah. And I won. I won the race, and it put me on the map overnight. So literally, without writing that letter, and Tom going, yeah, give him a chance, I would have been absolutely nowhere in motorsport. Long, long ago, sort of faded away from saloon car racing, running our own car. So that beating those great names put me on the map overnight.
How often did you speak to Tom? He wasn't in Formula One for that long, was he? But he was sort of coming and going. He was a wheeler dealer. Was he a friend? Was he a...
Yeah, Tom was like a second father to me. So he was, he trusted me and I trusted him implicitly. So whenever he was heading off somewhere, start something new, he wanted me to be involved and to give it a try and give him some feedback. To his frustration, I mean, he talked me out of leaving Formula One at the end of 1987 because he saw I was just spinning my wheels and going nowhere. I had a year in the Zach Speed. And the first thing that happened is I won the Daytona 24 Hours with the gang. Then I won the World Sports Car Championship. And next thing is I'm back in a Brabham. So to Tom's absolute annoyance, every time my career, my cred took an upturn, I rushed straight back to Formula One. I then did it again for 1990 and was part of the Le Mans winning team and won some other races for him. And by the end of 91, I'm back in a Brabham again. And then Tom went to Benetton, of course, with Ross Brawn and Flavio Briatore. And Tom made sure I got a a team shirt in that against Michael Schumacher. So Tom was absolutely pivotal to my racing career.
You say he's your second father. Can we just talk about your old man? Is that where your passion for driving came from? What made Martin Brundle want to be a racer? I mean, I know it takes me back to something I said earlier, but did it come from your dad, your mum, your mates?
My dad, sadly, we lost my dad at 59, and Tom was only about 61 when he died. So they didn't hang around very long, sadly. Two or three of my mentors, Ken Tyrrell was another one, actually. Great people who you look up to. And so dad was a rally driver. But I did a bit of rallying. I have done rallying. I've done rallycross, truck racing. I've done
everything.
Yeah, because I just love going fast.
Yeah.
So and we had car garages, so I could build my own cars, basically. Old anything that had failed its MOT or was unsaleable at the end of the used car lot, I'd take the windows out, put a roll cage in it, plumb a radiator into the back window so that it wasn't exposed at the front, strip all the interior out, and then go and tell my dad to take it off the inventory because it was a bit rusty and it was never going to sell, so I've turned it into a racing car. I ran a grass track. I currently live 4 miles away from all these years later, and this was late 1970s. So that's sort of what got me into it, and mum did a bit of autocross as well. And my parents were just hugely generous in that they just let me get on and do this sort of thing. Nobody ever suggested I should do it. I used to save up for a karting magazine, let alone the kart, so that was out of the question. But because I had access to these old end-of-the-line car deals, rusty old Fords, that gave me the opportunity. And so Dad would drop me off on a Sunday morning. I'd race all day, and when he'd finish selling cars, whatever time that was on a Sunday night, he'd come and pick me up again, and I'd have it all loaded up and ready to go. And then one day a guy ran into me in a Ford Zephyr 6, great big car, came after me with a crowbar afterward because I just won the race and he wasn't very happy about it. We used to have a mixed final and we're out of here. So we lied about my age, said I was 16 and went hot rod racing with Speedworth on the ovals. And then it started to get serious, or did it really? I had 3 slick tyres and 1 wet. So we put the 2 slicks across the rear, and obviously oval circuits, you only went one way round those. So my best 2 wheels were on the crowd side. My worst wheel, but with a slick on it, was on the right rear. And then the wet went on the right front. And that's how I went hot rod racing.
Do you know, this reminiscing, the smile on your face makes me think you look back at this time very affectionately.
I do, because we were winging it and somehow made it through. Which is why I don't always have a lot of sympathy for some of the ballerinas today when they think they're having it tough.
Are you still involved in car industry, road car? I mean, do you still sell cars? Do you have any garages?
No, we sold the garages.
Brother Robin?
10 years. Yeah, we ran them for a good while, but I'm very pleased to say we got rid of them 10 years ago. I'm an ambassador for Aston Martin, so I'm still involved in the motor industry in that respect, but no, we got out of that business.
So the family business is motor racing now. Yep. So it was inevitable, I suppose, that son Alex was always going to...
Yeah, our son's a racer, sports car racer. My daughter's a designer, car designer, but she ploughed her own furrow. She wanted to...
Did she ever race? Did Charlie ever race?
No, but we do some Palmer Sport days, and Charlie's very quick, actually, really quick around there. So, but she hasn't raced. I'd like to see Charlie do a race, actually.
Okay. Now... I saw you at the Goodwood Festival of Speed recently, driving car number, F1 car number 52
was for me.
And you were speaking very passionately about that car.
The Dan Gurney Eagle Westlake V12, most beautiful car. I think it's a major contender for most beautiful F1 car of all time. Sounded glorious, drove beautifully. It's a great honour and a great responsibility to drive, you know, the only American car that ever won a Formula One race. And Dan Gurney's own car could barely reach the pedals because he was 6'2" and the car was made for him. So I had 2 great big pieces of foam, and every time I hit the throttle and the V12 lit up, I sank into the foam and couldn't reach the pedals anymore. It was a little bit scary going up the hill, but you give it a bit of a go anyway. And I also drove Stirling Moss's, so Stirling's Cooper T43 as well up the hill a few times, which is very nimble, lovely little car, horrible gearbox, but I mean, he was a giant killer in that car.
I mean, so you have driven cars from pretty much every decade, haven't
yeah.
you?
Yeah, Fangios, yeah, Mercedes,
right, the way through to contemporary.
Right up to, I've driven three of the latest hybrid cars, yeah.
So you're in a very good position to answer my next question, which is, if you had your time again, which cars were the most fun? Which cars would you have loved to have raced?
Well, these cars, because I spent all of my career debriefing after every session, end of every day, writing reports and constantly thinking, how do I make my car go faster? And it was, you know, a little bit here and a little bit there, get rid of a bit of understeer, you know, try and make the gearbox work a little bit better, whatever it was. Fast forward, now you've got a car that's close to perfection. Personally, I don't think they're very exciting, as exciting to watch, because they don't move around and the drivers can't really make mistakes with the gears or what have you. But so I spent all my life trying to go faster. So I would always choose the car that goes the fastest, which are these cars, and they stick to the road. I like driving the old cars because I admire the bravery of the craziness of no seat belts. Fuel tanks somewhere to rest your elbows.
But even your era, I mean, you walk around the Formula One paddock now, you walk with a limp, Helmut Marko, Niki Lauda, all you guys are survivors.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I mean, a little bit earlier, you referred to the current mob as ballerinas. I mean,
but the skills have transferred.
Is it too safe now? Do you feel that the people at home watching are thinking these guys aren't doing something, are doing something? Do you think people at home think they could drive one of these?
They must do occasionally when they go on some of the onboard shots or if they see a great big car park for a runoff, but they'd be wrong because the cars are unbelievably fast. The acceleration is relentless to the point that it frightened me when I drove Lewis's car. I thought, if I don't take my foot off the throttle soon, I will actually take off because it just never stopped accelerating. So the skills are transferred now to, you know, they brake within a metre or two. I mean, we used to turn up in a corner and if you were still pointing in the right direction, in the right gear, and you made the apex, that was a start. Now, you know, if they brake 2 meters too early, they've thrown the lap away. And so the precision with which they drive now and the speed they carry, it really impresses me. They are brave. They're carrying a lot of speed in places. The difference is that they're probably not going to hospital or the mortuary if they get it wholly wrong at any given point. And the cars I've driven from the 50s and 60s, really catch your attention and you quickly begin to realise, and when I drove Fangio's 196, I think it was, you know what, if something goes wrong, I will actually, jumping out of this looks like the best option, not running into something in it. But they were pioneers, they were gladiators in from post-war years when, you know, running off the track and hitting a tree and dying in a ball of fire seemed obviously just one of the acceptable consequences of being a racing driver.
And where do you fit in this? Do you relate to that sort of Spitfire pilot mentality, or do you relate more to the current?
I relate more
Halo,
to those
halo-clad.
I relate more to those days when you really were taking a risk and you were doing something. You've got to be doing something out there that people either couldn't do or wouldn't do. That's the key thing.
So, the old Le Mans?
I raced at Le Mans recently.
But no
fantastic.
Chicane?
Yeah, the no chicane.
Is that when men were men?
No chicane. You're just sitting there waiting for something to break on those. That's
you don't,
just
do you relax?
That's the luck of the draw.
Do you relax at 250
no,
miles?
No, 240 is the highest I ever did, but that's day and night, 400 kilometres. No, you're keeping an eye on things because also you've got the tram lines and the crown of the road and back markers and debris and a little bit of mist and fog occasionally and the smell of the barbecue smoke down the Mulsanne. In a way, I think it's more dangerous having to brake twice, but back then you were just a little bit like here at the old Hockenheim, actually. You headed off into the country and really you were in the lap of the gods, whether it was going to blow up or break or something while you're out there. You could make a bit of a difference in some of the chicanes, but it was all about the engine. So I don't like it when I see Cox Corner and Eau Rouge, for example, reduced to being straights, effectively, to being full throttle zones. I don't like to see drivers coming out of the pits on an out lap and going flat out through Eau Rouge, because that used to be a corner where you had to build up to it all weekend until your final qualifying lap, and then it's like, let's get this done. We've got to go flat through Eau Rouge now. Same at 130R. But so those challenges, I'm afraid that's just life the way it is these days, and the health and safety aspect, or is it wholly unacceptable for somebody to be injured or die in the name of sport these days? Probably. But I do think you need to be a gladiator.
Did you accept the risks back then?
Totally. Yeah.
And wife Liz knew that?
Yeah, Liz is a racing wife. I had two kids, and you still become a very selfish person. And you, when you step into the side, or when you stepped over the side of a Formula One car back in those days, there was a reasonable chance you would be killed, injured, or paralyzed, or at least have a nasty shunt. So you treated it with respect, so I used to balance that risk. I wouldn't fly on dodgy airlines. I wouldn't walk down the side, and I still don't today, walk down the side of a very busy road. Burglar alarms and fire alarms in my house. So you try to manage the risk and try and drive safe cars. And that's why I ride a motorbike and fly a helicopter and generally take a lot of risks. So I think if you're an inherent risk taker, the only drivers I knew who were apparently totally fearless died, basically. Stefan Beloff would be a good example of that.
Well, yeah. I wanted to ask you about
you've got to have, you have to have an element of self-preservation somewhere in there, but then you've also got to be prepared to take risks and die, because otherwise, and the moments when you really knew if you still wanted to do it would be, again, here at Hockenheim on Mons in the pouring rain, you're doing 220 miles an hour, you can't see where you're going, and you press the throttle a little bit harder. When you lift the throttle, it's time to stop.
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Did you have that self-preservation prior to your shunt at Dallas? Or is that what instilled it in you?
Because no, it didn't change anything.
Because you could argue, couldn't you, that a lot of the guys you say who killed themselves in racing cars hadn't had that warning shot. Something Alain Prost said to me recently was that you have to have a wake-up call.
Yeah.
So realize exactly how dangerous it is. Maybe you had that at Dallas.
Well, I had exactly the opposite, actually. So Dallas was a nothing crash. I'd already crashed at Monaco when the brakes failed into Tabac in the very low side of Tyrrell. I hit my head on the barrier and I hit my head on the racetrack in the same accident, both of which had knocked myself out, but all of which would probably keep you out of a car for some months. Ran back and jumped in the spare car, but didn't know where I was.
So just for the people who weren't familiar with that race, did you actually get in the car?
I got in the car, and then I asked Ken Tyrrell, said, you've got 8 minutes left, you've got to get on with it, you're 22nd, with only 20 starters back then. And I said, no problem, which track am I at? I couldn't think where to go when I got to the end of the pit lane, whether I was going to go left or right.
All right.
So I'd sort of come around enough to get myself in the car, and I do remember sitting thinking, left or right at the end of the pit?
So Uncle Ken
And they
said,
took me out. They yeah. leaned in, switched off, and took me out, took me away. But and then, of course, I had a massive shunt in 94 when Jos Verstappen came bounding down the track and ran over my head. And another massive shunt in 1996 in Melbourne. So it's a matter of when you crash in Formula in Formula Race, not if you. You always have crashed. I had three big crashes in my career. And I was actually Mr. Bring It Home, I must say. I was quite well known for being in the points, especially in sports car racing. I was Mr. Reliable, always bring them, but I'm actually famous for three very big crashes. And so why it was different for me is I got to the end of there thinking, well, I survived all that. I'm fine, I'm invincible. So actually, it probably made me a little bit more crazy.
Okay. Now, we talked about Schumacher and Senna and Hakkinen and people, but Beloff, just to go back to him, bit mad, you say, but how fast was he? And for people at home, you were his teammate.
Yeah,
so you knew him inside out.
Yeah, he was. We came at it in a different way. But we were almost like there was a piece of string between us. Either I was just in front of him or he was just in front of me in a lot of races and our normally aspirated Tyrrells. then he would make two or three moves, like Zandvoort. Come on, Martin, come on. You know, he's getting away from you. Come on. And then two laps later, be behind me because he made another move that was actually never on, had an incident. Now he's, you know, behind me again on the race lap. But he was a very fast boy. Scary to be with on the road, scary to be with on the racetrack. And he apparently knew no fear. Was Gilles Villeneuve a bit like that? I didn't know him, but I suspect he, you know, from what tales I've heard on the track and flying his heli and all that, was a little bit fearless. Yeah.
Were you a prankster then? Going back to these characters, you know, were you in the same era as Gerhard Berger?
No, Gerhard was the... I was...
Was he another level?
Kid from Norfolk, I didn't know... So out of my depth, I was so green.
To all our listeners in Norfolk, Martin loves you.
I was absolutely green, but...
Was it more fun back then? I mean, you could still see.
We used to go...
Camaraderie among the drivers.
We used to go to Rio for 3 weeks. We'd test for a week, have a week off, and then go to the race.
Hang out together during that week.
Hang out together around the pool. Right. Yeah, it was... You know, Tom, what goes on the road stays on the road. So we don't tell stories, but we had a lot of fun. And things happen. And as happens today as well. But
less I think, so.
Possibly less so, but the drivers are, you know, we didn't have social media back in those days. We didn't have somebody taking photographs on Twitter. We didn't have mega sponsors who were sensitive to how you were presented in any, you know, at any given time. So it has changed, and I don't envy the drivers one little bit in terms of that kind of pressure and the media attention that they get. So, but they were larger than life characters. There's no doubt about it. Coming from all sorts of directions.
Were you ever tempted to try and get involved in the management of Formula One or the management of a racing team to use this wealth of knowledge you have in a race, focus it in a racing sense rather than a broadcasting sense?
Well, I've been chairman of the Grand Prix Drivers Association, which was after Ayrton and Roland died. We had a meeting and the drivers decided I seemed to be the right guy to control it or to run it, as it were. My co-directors were Michael Schumacher and Gerhard Berger. I've been chairman of the board at Silverstone, running Silverstone. So I do like that kind of element. I do, you know, I'm chairman of a charity. And so it appeals to me. And I managed David Coulthard for 11 years and ran my own businesses. So the business side appeals to me a lot. But I've been a driver and then a media person through all of that phase. There's a lot cleverer people than me to run this business. And that's why they run it, and I just talk about it.
Yeah, well, not true. I just say, Coulthard, actually, interesting to hear you mention his name. 11 years managing him. How was he to manage? Anything you do differently now? I mean, 9 years at McLaren. Were there any other options for him?
No, I look back. David and I are years later. Even closer than we were back then, which is very important to me. So we got through that phase and we didn't fall out. Nobody disappointed any, neither was disappointed the other on any commercial aspect, or we did our best. David won a lot of races. My frustration not winning a Formula One race is his frustration for not winning the World Championship when you had maybe the potential and the opportunity to do so. No, we did our best. We took our best decisions at the time. You can't punish yourself. Look back and punish yourself. You did your best at the time.
Yeah. Okay.
So and DC was a great driver, has become a great friend, and we work together. We share a room together. A lot of Grand Prix, me and DC.
Even now.
Which nobody can understand. It's like we share a room here in Hockenheim. Yeah. We have a twin room and. We never stopped laughing.
Does he snore?
Sometimes. Then I'm sure I do as well. No, we're great friends. So and people go like, why on earth do you do that? Like, well, we'd probably go and have a beer and have a bite to eat. And it started, me and Blundell used to share a room. It started in a hotel in Belgium where we're both paying 1,200 quid each to be in a room. And the walls were so thin, we had a conversation through the wall for about 3 hours. And we're like... Mate, we might as well share a room and save 1,200 quid next time. And it started like that. But
good tales. No. Were you not tempted to manage other drivers as well? F1 drivers? Was the opportunity
talked
ever
to
there?
One or two. Actually talked to one or two, but never quite came off. Mostly because they wanted exclusivity, and I was already nailed on with David. But I would, if I stopped doing the TV, I'd probably think of managing a driver. Yeah.
Okay. So look, I think a nice place to end this, Martin, is just how has a life in F1 changed you, or do you think you're still the same guy that was, or is it taking windscreens out of cars when your dad wasn't looking and putting a roll cage in them and stuff? Have you changed much, do you think?
I haven't changed dramatically as a person, but I've become a lot more worldly, and my fundamental view of people is that I trust people until they prove I can't trust them anymore. I've had to adjust that a little bit, I'm afraid, in this crazy high finance and pressurized world of ours. So I'm slightly more skeptical. I think everybody gets like that as they get older. So I like to think I'm the same approachable person. But I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot the hard way. I had some taskmasters like David Price in Formula 3, Eddie Jordan, Tom Walkinshaw, Ken Tyrrell, Ron Dennis, drove Frank Williams for a time. They're tough guys. And they tore me apart. And at that point, you're either going to leg it or you're going to put yourself back together again. And I put myself back together and came back stronger. But they're tough guys.
What do you mean, tore you apart?
Oh, my God.
Just in the deal? The deal?
The post-race thing. When I finished second to Piquet in Detroit, I went out to dinner with Ken and Nora Tyrrell, and I thought I was going to get congratulated all night long. And Ken ripped me a new one because it was, why did you, even Jackie thought you shouldn't have overtaken Elio in that chicane for second place, Elio De Angelis. I'm like, hang on a minute, did Jackie know that I knew Elio was missing third gear? He was coming out of a corner and just not accelerating. He had to go from second to fourth. So I nipped past him. And I nearly put one more lap and I'd have had Piquet as well for a victory. And I was quite upset about that. What Ken, in his clumsy way, was trying to tell me was, don't get cocky. 5 days later, I was in the wall in Dallas, going convinced I was going to be on pole position in a Tyrrell around a joke of a racetrack. It was just a parkland track lined with two concrete walls. It was his way of trying to keep the lid on me, keep my expectations down a little bit. So, but no, I mean, Ron was tough to drive for when I drove for him. Had me on a race by race contract, which is, as a McLaren driver, is nearly impossible.
Why do you think he did that?
Don't know. It was, I smashed David Price's racing car up, Formula 3 car up, and you're not going to do that a second time, I can tell you. But these guys define you, and in the end, they do you great favours. They do you a great favour. And you life's lessons, and they toughen you up, because when you hit the track and you start trying to fight something, when I came into F1, it was Rosberg, Prost, Piquet, Senna, De Angelis, Mansell, Lauda, Arnoux, Tambay, Lafitte.
So who's who of Formula 1 in that time, isn't it?
Yeah, tough.
Look, Martin, thank you. Thanks for your time. What a great track. Loved it.
Yeah, very good. Thank you.
He's the kind of guy you could listen to for hours, isn't he? Always so informative and articulate. And I loved those Senna stories. And what about that tale of Spa 92? All these years later, he's still kicking himself. That could have been the victory, couldn't it? Thanks for your time, Martin. Always great to chat. Next week, I'll be talking to another big name from F1. And I know many of you are heading off on your summer holidays now, so why don't you take me with you? Just subscribe and I'll appear on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favourite podcast app. And if you have something you want to tell us, then just drop us a line using the hashtag F1BeyondTheGrid, and you can reach me, as ever, on Twitter at TomClarksonF1. Beyond the Grid is produced by F1 in association with Audioboom. Until next time, keep it flat out.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.